How much information do you think exists in the entire world? Take a guess. Forget megabytes and gigabytes and terabytes and petabytes, even exabytes. We're talking zetabytes here, or 10 to the 21st bytes. Take that number 10, put 21 zeros after it. That's what you got. Because one recent estimate says there may be around 3 zetabytes of digital information out there. That's over 1 trillion gigabytes. Just imagine all those hard drives piled up, and then imagine them not starting up when you plug them in. There's got to be a better way to store all that data long term, right? For a long, long time. Because, you know, some of these CDs, DVDs, they're starting to wear out. I don't know, some of mine, some of our archival stuff is starting to lose its stuff. They're not playing anymore. Well, my next guest has come up with a solution that's much longer lasting. It's more compact than today's hard disks and magnetic tapes. And it is DNA. Nature uses DNA to store information, so why shouldn't we? And, you know, DNA can last for tens of thousands of years. Think of those Neanderthal bones. Nick Goldman is the leader of a research team studying molecular genome evolution at the European Bioinformatics Institute in the UK, and his paper on DNA data storage appears in the journal Nature this week, and he joins us by phone. Welcome to Science Friday, Dr. Goldman.
Thank you very much. Glad to be here.
How did you come up with the idea of storing information in DNA? Can DNA actually store those ones and zeros and things?
It stores the equivalent of ones and zeros. We came up with the idea in a bar in Hamburg a few years ago because the institute where I work keeps some of the world's big biological databases. We store the information, we archive the information, and we serve it to research biologists around the world over the internet for them to do their research. And the data that's coming into us is increasing exponentially. It's quite a headache for us to keep hold of all of that because our budgets don't increase exponentially.
Yeah. Did you actually try this out on some DNA?
Yeah, we tried it out in a real, it's sort of compared to the databases we store, it's a small example, but compared to what people have done before, it's a pretty big example. We wrote a computer program that embodied a code that would convert the zeros and ones from a hard disk drive into the letters that we use to represent DNA, and then our collaborators in California were able to actually to synthesize physical DNA.
And what did you store in that DNA?
We chose a few computer files that would just illustrate the range, but really, I mean, anything is just as possible, but we chose a photograph of our own institute because we're sort of self-publicists at heart, I guess. an excerpt from Martin Luther King's speech, I Have a Dream, all of Shakespeare's sonnets, and a PDF that contained, in fact, the paper, the scientific paper by Watson and Crick that first described the structure of DNA itself.
How is it possible? And let me ask you, how much DNA did that take? How much storage space physically did that all take up?
Physically, in our experiment, that took up, we couldn't really measure it in a scientific way, but between you and me, it's like a speck of dust.
All that stuff on a speck of dust?
Yeah.
And how much room would you need to store all the information in the world?
So I did a quick calculation the other day on the back of an envelope for that one, and I think you could do all the information in the world in 1.5 cubic meters. So it would sort of go in the back of your station wagon, I guess.
Wow. I'd be careful about where I was driving.
Really heavy. It would be bad for the suspension.
I'd worry that, you know, I drop it off somewhere. So is this a mass storage for libraries, or because we don't have the ability to translate that stuff into DNA, do we, at home? Not yet.
No, not at home, and it's still too expensive to do it on any sort of large scale. The prices are coming down really quickly. It's driven by the revolution in genome technology and genome research. And at the moment, we did some cost projections. At the moment, it's so expensive that it's only economically viable if you're going to store it for 600 or more than 1,000 years. On the long term, it's a good deal because once you've made the DNA, it costs nothing to maintain it in a good state.
All right, Nick, stay with us. We're going to take a break. We'll come back and talk a little more with you if that's okay with you. Our number 1-800-989-8255. talking with Nick Goldman about storing information on DNA. We'll be right back after this break. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We're talking with Nick Goldman about storing information on DNA. He's already tried this out. He's got all of Shakespeare's sonnets, Martin Luther King's speeches, text, files, photos, all in this, getting DNA to encode it all. Well, they encode it. This is synthetic DNA. You make the DNA yourself?
Our collaborators at a company called Agilent Technologies in California.
Yeah,
did that. They're one of the world leaders in the technologies that make DNA, synthetic DNA, to human designs.
And when we went to the break, you were saying that one of the advantages of in storing it in DNA is once you make it, it will last a very long time.
That's right. And you gave the example in your introduction that one of the examples we like to use, it's quite well known. You know, there's been these Neanderthal samples found, and they can get DNA out of there and read the DNA in technical, we call it, we sequence the DNA. And those samples from Neanderthals, or another great example is woolly mammoths. They get samples routinely from 10 or 20,000 or 50,000-year-old mammoths. And that's not even a carefully controlled sample. That's just, you know, a mammoth that lay down and died somewhere cold.
I'm sorry for the mammoth. But if you took your DNA, you would store it in a controlled environment somewhere, or does it not need that? If a mammoth is lying in the ice,
it doesn't really need it. But the first applications would be something of very, very high value. That's the only way you justify the currently high expense. Globally important historical documents or records of nuclear waste dumps or something like that. You could store it just in your house. I've got samples sitting around in my office, and they're not coming to any harm. But if you wanted to be extra cautious, you'd keep it cold, near freezing, and you'd keep it dry, and you'd keep it in the dark.
You know, those of us who are of the science fiction ilk would think of these dangerous sequences, you know, of events where somehow the bacteria or other organisms see your Shakespeare sonnet DNA and say, I want to read that and suck it up and turn it into something else.
The code we use to store information in DNA is completely different from the code that living organisms on Earth use in their DNA. So it's no more dangerous to have the information stored in DNA that way than a piece of plastic's dangerous because you can make a CD out of it.
Okay, now let's talk nuts and bolts here, Nick. How close are we to actually getting something of practical use outside of the experimental laboratory here?
We don't know because we're relying on technology to improve to bring those prices down. But we've looked at what's been going on in the last few years driven by genome research, and that the most expensive stage is synthesizing DNA. The prices there drop by a factor of 10 about every 5 years. So 10 years from now, it will be 100 times cheaper. And our projections are that at that point, it's something you or I might be able to afford to do for information that was of great value to us that we wanted to keep on something like a 50-year timescale. And that's something like, you know, maybe that will be my children taking a video recording of their wedding and wanting to put that somewhere safe for their grandchildren. It will be expensive, but it will be possible. And if you care enough about the information you want to pass down through a couple of generations, you might choose to do it.
Yeah, I'll place it on the shelf right next to my 3D printer when I
it would be safe there.
One question with all this stuff in the DNA, how could you find that sonnet? If you had everything in the world in the back of your station wagon, how do you index that and find what you're looking for?
You're right. You'd have to decide how much you wanted to clump together into. You wouldn't put it all in the back in one big box in the back of the car. You'd separate it up into whatever was a useful size unit. And this isn't a new problem. That's what we do with all the words in all the books in a library, right? We don't put them in one big bin and say your information's in there. We order them on the page and we put the pages in a book and we have an index system so we can look it up. And we'd have to invent the same kind of system to index different test tubes with information about different things in them.
All right, Nick, we're going to meet you back here in 10 years, okay, and see how far you've gotten.
Okay, I'll make a date.
All right, Nick Goldman, leader of research team studying molecular genome evolution at the European Bioinformatics Institute in the UK on storing all this information. We can just make DNA out of it, and it lasts for thousands of years. Thanks, Nick, for joining us this hour.
It's my pleasure.
How much did you pay for that last box of Girl Scout cookies you bought? Five bucks? Six, maybe? Maybe more? How about $15 billion? That's the price of a single box. If it were turned into graphene. Researchers at Rice University in Houston have discovered a way to turn anything with carbon into graphene, the super strong wonder material that can be worth over 2 million times the price of gold. You heard that right. 2 million times. Forget alchemy. That's for chumps. This is graphene worth a lot more in its weight of gold. Mark Abrams, editor and founder of the Annals of Improbable Research, is here to tell us why graphene is so pricey and what this invention could mean for nanotechnology. Welcome back to Science Friday.
Thanks, Ira. Nice to be back.
So what is this thing about turning Girl Scout cookies into graphene?
All right. We'll start with a little reminder about graphene. Graphene is just a form of carbon. It's a form of carbon people knew existed, but just about 8 or so years ago, for the first time, people were able to get enough of it to actually look at it. Mm-hmm. It's the two-dimensional form. It's like a big sheet of chicken wire. It's the shape. And it's really hard to get. The guys who figured it out did it in a goofy way using pencil and scotch tape. When you write with a pencil, that stuff that comes off, that graphite,
right.
That's really sheets and sheets and sheets of this thin stuff. But separating those, that was expensive. The numbers you've tossed around show you how expensive. People have been able to do experiments. They've found all kinds of really interesting, possibly valuable properties, but nothing, no industry is really going to start until they can make enough of this stuff cheaply to use it. Until now, most of the ways of making it started with this first step. Get some really pure, really expensive chemicals that you're going to mix in and do the next stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Huge expense. What Jim Tour down in Houston discovered and showed is that anything that's got carbon in it, you can turn into graphene. And to demonstrate that he meant anything, he did it with Girl Scout cookies. He turned those into graphene. He did it with chocolate. He got some chocolate half-dollar coins. Did it with dog feces from a miniature dachshund. And he did it with a cockroach leg. And essentially, he just got a really big oven, heated it up to about 1,000 degrees C, and filled that oven with a little bit of this stuff, the cockroach or the dog feces, whatever, and a sheet of pure copper and a little bit of gas, left it for about 20 minutes, and voila, he had made little bits of really high-quality graphene.
Wow.
He was making still little tiny amounts. It's still really expensive, but if you just do out the little numbers from it, from the amount he made, if you could convert all of the cookies in a standard box of Girl Scout cookies, if you can convert all of the carbon in them into graphene, when he did this a year and a half ago, that would be worth about $15 billion.
Are those the things today?
Yes.
Yeah.
And now it's the techniques have got better, so now it would only be worth about $12 billion.
Are those the thin mints?
No, these were the shortbread.
Oh.
But you could do it with thin mints. There's
what a waste of those thin mints. They wouldn't last long in my kitchen.
Well, so you're just throwing away money when you do that, Ira.
Can anybody do this? And is this being adopted and adapted by commercial industry?
Well, anybody with a little equipment could do it. The thing is, it's still not easy and it's still really expensive because you can only make, right now, they only know how to make really, really, really tiny amounts. But the big thing he was trying to show is you don't have to start with really expensive feedstocks, is the chemical term. You can make this stuff from anything. So once people figure out their techniques a little bit better, the prospects for a huge drop in price are great. Now, of course, there are other problems with this stuff. There's not enough of it that people have figured out a lot of the technical problems. Like if you make electronics from graphene, it has all these beautiful properties. But if you make them, you got to connect them to wires. And the connector problem, you know, just in a way, it's a version of when you plug something into your computer, how do you connect it?
Right.
How do you connect something to a sheet of carbon that's one atom thick so that it's reliable? and does what you want it to. People are working on that. Yeah. That's still a mystery.
Yeah, that's why they work there and I work here.
Yep. But someday.
Yeah, someday. Thank you, Mark. Fascinating as always.
Okay, we'll see you.
Mark Abrams, editor and founder of the Annals of Improbable Research. He's also the founder and master of ceremonies, excuse me, at the Ig Nobel Prize ceremonies that you hear every year the Friday after Thanksgiving right here.
Federal safety investigators remain perplexed by what caused a battery on a Boeing 787 to burst into flames earlier this month in Boston. The 787, as a class of airplanes, is now grounded worldwide. And at a briefing yesterday, the head of the National Transportation Safety Board warned it could be a long time before the plane is cleared to fly. NPR's Wendy Kaufman reports.
Thus far, investigators from the NTSB have looked at the charred remains of the battery in the electrical system with CT scans. They've taken component pieces apart and used sophisticated technology to examine and test them. They've pored over documents, but they still don't know all that much about the sequence of events that produced a battery fire so intense that it took firefighters more than an hour and a half to extinguish it. Still, the chairman of the safety board, Deborah Hirschman, left no doubt that our agency intended to find the root cause.
We do not expect to see fire events on board aircrafts. This is a very serious air safety concern, and we are all responding to try to address what happened, why it happened, and to make sure that the aircraft that fly are safe.
The battery involved was a 63-pound lithium-ion battery. Lithium-ion batteries are known to catch fire, and the FAA imposed special conditions on Boeing's use of the battery. Extra safety measures were required. Nevertheless, there was what investigators describe as a thermal runaway inside the battery. That's an uncontrolled chemical reaction between the electrolytes and the electrodes. Also inside the battery, investigators found evidence of high current damage from a short circuit. Aviation safety expert Hans Weber offers some possible explanations.
It could have been started within the battery due to, for example, a manufacturing defect. It could have been the circuitry that protects the battery against overcharging or excessive discharging and things of that nature. It could have been something else in the electronics control circuitry.
The NTSB will be probing other areas, too. One big one, how did the Federal Aviation Administration go about approving or certifying this new and highly innovative airplane? Here's what the Safety Board's Hirschman wants to know.
Were those certification standards adhered to? And then the question of, were they appropriate? We will be working very closely with a number of groups, including the FAA and Boeing, as we collect that information and evaluate the analysis and the risk assessments that were done.
The NTSB says it will also be exploring safety concerns raised by more than one whistleblower. In addition, investigators are working with a team in Japan probing the cause of a severe battery failure on another 787. With no clear answers or even great clues, the Safety Board's investigation into the Boston fire will likely take some time. And once the cause is known, Boeing will have to come up with a fix, and the FAA will have to test and approve it. Aviation analyst Scott Hamilton warns that Boeing's 787s could remain grounded indefinitely.
Indefinite is indefinite. Whether that's 2 months, 3 months, 6 months, we don't know, but it's not going to be back in the air anytime soon.
Last night, Boeing said it's continuing to work tirelessly on the problem and is assisting investigations in the U.S. and in Japan. The airplane maker added that it deeply regrets the impact this is having on its airline customers and their passengers. What Boeing didn't say was that it deeply regrets what all this has done to its reputation and that of its flagship airplane. Wendy Kaufman, NPR News, Seattle.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Renee Montagne.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Today in Your Health, we're going to explore the way machines affect your health.
To be precise, we'll ask how your relationship with machines affects you.
People spend so much time now with computers, iPhones, and other gadgets, and it gets to the point where many of us might treat machines almost like people.
When your computer is nice to you, it may prompt you to be nice in return. NPR's Elise Spiegel reports.
Stanford professor Clifford Nath first got interested in exploring the limits of the rule of reciprocity in 1996.
Every culture has a rule of reciprocity, which roughly means if I do something nice for you, you will do something nice for me.
But Nath doesn't study cultures. He studies technologies, how we interact with them. And so his interest in the rule of reciprocity had a very particular twist.
We wanted to see whether people would apply that to technology. Would they help a computer that helped them more than a computer that didn't help them?
And so Nass arranged a series of experiments. In the first, people were led into a room with two computers and placed at one which, they were told, could answer any of their questions.
In the first experiment, the computer was very helpful. When you asked a question, it gave a great answer.
So the humans sat there, asked their questions for about 20 minutes, and then?
And then the computer said, this computer is trying to improve its performance, and it needs your help.
The humans were then asked to do a very, very tedious task that involved matching colors for the computer.
Selections after selections after selections. It was very boring.
Here, though, is the trick.
Half the people were asked to do this color matching by the computer they had just worked with. The other half of people were asked to do the color matching by a computer across the room. Now, if these were people, we would expect that if I just helped you and then I asked you for help, you would feel obligated to help me a great deal. But if I just helped you and someone else asked you to help, you would feel less obligated to help them.
Before I explain the results, know that they also did a version with an extremely unhelpful computer, a computer terrible at answering questions. And taken together, Nass says, these experiments show that people do obey the rule of reciprocity with computers. When the first computer was helpful, people helped it way more than the other computer in the room on the boring task.
They reciprocated, but when the computer didn't help them, they actually did more color matching for the computer across the room than the computer they work with, teaching the computer a lesson for not being helpful.
Now, very likely, the humans involved had no idea that they were treating these computers so differently. Their own behavior was probably invisible to them. Nass says that all day long, our interaction with the machines around us is subtly shaped by social rules that we aren't necessarily aware we're applying to non-humans.
The relationship is profoundly social. The human brain is built when given the slightest hint that something is even vaguely social or vaguely human. In this case, it was just answering questions. It didn't have a face on the screen. It didn't have a voice. But given the slightest hint of humanness, people will respond with an enormous array of social responses, including, in this case, reciprocating and retaliating.
Change the way a machine looks or behaves, tweak its level of intelligence, and you can manipulate the way that humans interact with it. Which raises this question. What would happen if a machine explicitly addressed us as if it were a social being, a being with a soul? What would happen, for instance, if a machine begged for its life? Would we be able to hold in mind that in actual fact, this machine cared as much about being turned off as your television or your toaster? That is, that the machine didn't care about losing its life at all.
Right. My name is Christoph Bartnick, and I study the interaction between humans and robots.
Christoph Bartnick is a professor at the University of Canterbury in New Zealand who recently did an experiment which tested exactly this. Humans were asked to end the life of a robot as it begged for its own survival. In the study, the robot, an expressive cat that talks like a human, sits side by side with a human research subject, and together they play a game against a computer. Half the time the cat robot is intelligent and helpful, half the time not. Bartnick also varied how socially skilled the cat robot was.
So if the robot would be agreeable, the robot would ask, you know, could I possibly make a suggestion now? But if it was not agreeable, it would say, it's my turn now, do this.
At the end of the game, nice or mean, smart or dumb, the scientist would make clear that the human needed to turn the cat robot off.
And it was made clear to them what the consequences of this would be, namely that they would essentially eliminate everything that the robot was, all of its memories, all of its behavior, all of its personality would be gone forever.
Switch me off.
Yes.
You are not really going to switch me off.
Yes, I will.
Are you?
You made a stupid choice.
You're not really going to turn me off, are you? The cat robot begs. And in the tapes of the experiment, you can hear the human struggle, confused and hesitating.
I will switch you off. I will switch you off. please.
No, please.
People actually start to have dialogues with the robot about this. For example, say, you know, no, I really have to do it now. I'm sorry, you know, it has to be done. But they still wouldn't do it. They would still hesitate.
Please. You can decide to keep me switched on. Please.
There they sit in front of a machine that is no more soulful than a hairdryer. A machine they know intellectually is just a collection of electrical pulses and metal. And yet, they pause, waiting, until finally they turn the knob that kills it.
This will happen. Now!
Every participant eventually did kill the robot, but it took them time to muster the strength to do it, to intellectually override their emotional queasiness.
What we found is that, let's say, a smart and agreeable robot, the participant would approximately take 35 seconds before they would have completed the switching off procedure.
On one level, there are clear practical implications to studies like these. Bartnick says the more we know about machine-human interaction, the better we can build our machines. For example,
if the robot has to recharge its batteries, if it would just say, my batteries are almost empty, or if it would say, I'm sorry, but my batteries are almost empty. Can you please recharge me? I think you'd get different results.
But on a more philosophical level, studies like these can help to track where we are in terms of our relationship to the evolving technologies in our lives.
This relationship is certainly something that is in flux, so it is not. There is no one way of how we deal with technology and it doesn't change. It is something that does change.
More and more intelligent machines are integrated into our lives. They come into our beds, they come into our bathrooms. And as they do, and as they present themselves to us differently, our responses to them change. Both Bartnick and Nass believe this. But I thought I'd talk to one last technology expert.
Siri?
Siri here. How may I help you?
Siri, do you like me?
What a question. Of course I'm your friend.
Okay, Siri, goodbye.
Until next time.
Elise Spiegel, NPR News, Washington.
Reading used to be a private act, just you and your imagination immersed in another world. But now, if you curl up with an e-reader, you're not alone. Data is being collected about your reading habits, and that information belongs to the companies who sell e-readers, like Amazon or Barnes & Noble. They can also share or sell that information. One Barnes & Noble official has said that sharing data with publishers might help authors create even better books. Well, that got NPR's Lynn Neary wondering, what do novelists think of that idea?
People who buy electronic readers may think it's a great way to read a book, but they might not realize it's also a brilliant marketing tool. E-readers, says best-selling author Scott Turow, can glean a lot of information about their owners.
You can tell everything about how somebody reads a book, you know, whether they're the kind who skip to the end, how fast they read, what they skip. So, you know, they can give the author specifically the feedback as, you know, 35% of the people who bought this book quit after the first two chapters.
Turow, who is also president of the Authors Guild, says this kind of information can be very useful to a writer.
I mean, I would love to know if 35% of my readers were quitting after the first two chapters, because that, frankly, strikes me as sometimes a problem I could fix. But yeah, would I love to be able to hitch the equivalent of a polygraph to my readers and know how they're actually responding word by word? That would be quite interesting.
There's no question, says novelist Jonathan Evison, that writers are keenly interested in how readers respond to their work. But he says that doesn't mean a writer wants to tailor his work just to please the reader.
I'd be lying if I said I wasn't thinking about the reader all the time. I always think about the reader. You know, I'm trying to create an effect for the reader and sort of engage them in sort of a collaborative dance, I guess it is. But I'm still trying to be the leader.
The idea that data collected from e-readers might be used by publishers to improve a writer's work strikes Evison as wrong. It feels like creating by committee, he says, and reminds him of the days when he worked in commercial radio and met with general managers and program directors.
And they'd show me just thick packets of research that were all demographics. We did, you know, with focus groups, we did studies. These are the 100 songs we want you to play for your bumpers because these are the ones people like best. And this is what we want you to talk about. These are the sort of evergreen subjects that people like. People like topical. They would tell me all this. And what would happen is my show started to lose its voice.
What would have happened, says Evison, if this kind of research had been around when some of the world's greatest and most challenging books had been written? War and Peace, Ulysses, Moby Dick.
I mean, Moby Dick is one of my favorite books, but let's face it, it's a hot mess. You know what I mean? If I had a software that said, look, you know, maybe this 4-page, you know, essay on Scrimshaw isn't going to fly with your 28 to 40 male demo, you know, what would we have lost with that? Sometimes, you know, it's got to be a little bit of a dictatorship.
There is nothing collaborative about writing a novel, says Scott Turow. It's one person's vision. On the other hand, he says, it makes sense for publishers to try to figure out what readers want. After all, publishers are trying to make money.
You know, there's a certain logic to that from the business side. Why should we publish this book if 11 readers out of 12 can't make it through page 36? But the 12th reader may be more discerning in her tastes, and, you know, it could turn out that what people are thumbing their nose at is Ulysses, or the novels of Faulkner.
Of course, there are different kinds of novels. Turow writes best-selling legal thrillers. Jennifer Egan writes literary fiction. In her book, A Visit from the Goon Squad, Egan played with the form of the novel. Although it was commercially successful and critically well-received, Egan knows for some readers, the novel just didn't work.
When I hear that someone couldn't connect with Goon Squad or found it too far out or couldn't get traction with it, I really do feel I failed that person. I don't at all subscribe to this idea that somehow they didn't, quote unquote, get it. And I'm sorry about it. That being said, I think it is silly and kind of childish to expect to write a book like Goon Squad, which is kind of idiosyncratic, does not follow a lot of the narrative conventions we've come to expect from contemporary novels, is not straightforward. I think one can't do all that and then expect to be loved by everyone.
Egan suspects that information drawn from an e-book would show that a lot of readers skipped over one chapter in particular. It was written as a PowerPoint presentation.
While I respect the opinions of those who didn't connect with that PowerPoint chapter, and I really am sympathetic as someone who myself is kind of alienated by PowerPoint, I believe that chapter is the heart of the book. And I think without it, the experience of the book is not complete. And I say that, you know, knowing that many people were alienated by it. And I guess this speaks to the question of how important market research really would be for me as a, you know, as a creative person. Interesting to know, but should not necessarily be predictive or part of the creative process.
And anyway, Egan says she doubts Faulkner would have changed one word of Absalom Absalom on the basis of market research. Lynn Neary, NPR News, Washington.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Detailed satellite images are helping to expose a system of huge prison camps in North Korea, camps that North Korea says don't even exist. Western governments and human rights groups estimate that as many as 200,000 political prisoners are held in these camps under horrific conditions. And a small contingent of Western bloggers is scrutinizing the satellite images, trying to map the camps and look for new detail. Curtis Melvin is among them. He started the website North Korean Economy Watch. Thanks for coming in.
Hi, how are you doing?
You have a recent discovery based on new Google Earth images, a possible new camp. What did you see that struck you?
So in January, Google uploaded
lots of new satellite imagery from all over North Korea, and I have the ambition to go through all of it and check for what's new, things that have changed, look for developments within the country. And a colleague of mine contacted me and asked me a question about Camp 18, because there is actually a debate as to whether Camp 18 has been closed.
These numbered camps, who numbers the camps? Where do these numbers come from?
Those would be set by the Ministry for State Security in North Korea, essentially the KGB of North Korea. And as I began to look around Camp 18 and Camp 14, which are right next to each other, I noticed a new security perimeter had gone up approximately 20 kilometers in circumference next to the existing Camp 14.
How could you tell? What did the perimeter look like?
Well, in the past, in 2006, when we had the last available satellite image of the location, there is no security perimeter at all. There's a village there. There's a coal mine that had fallen into disuse. And with the new satellite imagery, we can see where they've actually carved out a clearing, making a very visible straight lines with positions for guard posts stationed at regular intervals.
Can you see a detail as granular as, say, there are guard houses along this perimeter? What does it look like? How can you tell?
Little squares. The big tell is, one, they're right up next to the border. Two, they're identical all the way around for the most part.
When you and other people who are studying these images try to corroborate them, what do you do to try to flesh out what you're seeing in these images?
Initially, the hard work was done by the Committee for Human Rights in North Korea in 2003, because when they published the initial reports with the satellite imagery, then we had a base to work from. And so in North Korea, they tend to do everything the same way. And once you know what a particular kind of place looks like in North Korea, it's very easy to spot that same kind of thing.
What tells you this is a camp?
It's a security perimeter guarding nothing in particular except what appears to be a regular village. Most of the factories, military factories in North Korea have walls on them. A lot of them even have guard turrets on them. But there's something going on inside that's very obvious that they're protecting. And in the case of these labor camps, there's nothing inside. You see regular houses, maybe some fish ponds or something like that there, but there's nothing that tells you there's anything special or horrible about it. But ultimately, for me to be convinced, we have to have eyewitness accounts.
And by eyewitness accounts, you're talking about defectors, people who had been in North Korea, some of them in these camps, who've managed to get out.
Or have had relatives who've been put in there, or had experience dealing with some of the guards, or might have been guards.
How would those accounts back up what you see in these images exactly?
Well, if they can describe the place, which has been done many times in the past, they can usually describe the area without looking at a satellite image, and then there's an amazing overlap between what they describe and physically draw, with the satellite imagery. And that's been done a number of times. I actually identified a regular prison that someone had testified about this place and drawn a picture of it. And I was actually able to look at the satellite imagery on Google Earth and match the hand drawing with the satellite picture.
It lined up.
Yeah.
Hmm. You devote a lot of time to poring over these images and trying to figure out what's going on in North Korea. Why do you do it? What keeps you going?
At this point, North Korea is a very exciting country because it's undergone a radical amount of change in the last 10 years. And satellite imagery is one of the few ways that we can get eyes on the ground in North Korea, because there's simply no other way for us to visualize or bring these things to bear in the West.
Curtis Melvin, thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
Curtis Melvin started the website North Korean Economy Watch. We were talking about satellite images of North Korean prison camps as seen on Google Earth.